even if your voice shakes. The freedom of Palestinians is connected to the fight against oppression all over the world. Lastly, to my city in Palestine, Ashanik, and Awek of Hannah, I stand here because of you. Thank you.
And the reason I support KVU is because, especially during this year, you're always there for me when I need you to be. And I just turn on the radio and I feel like I'm getting quality content. And I think that's really important. So thank you.
Why do you love KVU? Donate today and let us know at kboo.fm/give.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer Azarine Vandervliet Alumi. Alumi has degrees in creative writing and Latin American studies from the University of California, San Diego, and is a graduate of the MFA program in creative writing from Brown University. She's the author of the critically acclaimed novel Fra Keeler from Dorothy Publishing Project, a book lauded by everyone from Robert Coover to Lynn Tillman to Brian Evanson. She's also a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree, the recipient of a McDowell Fellowship, a Fulbright Fellowship in Fiction to Catalonia, Spain, a fellowship from the Instituto de las Letras Catalanes in Barcelona, and a 2015 Whiting Award. Her work has appeared in the Paris Review, Guernica, The Believer, Granta, Words Without Borders, and elsewhere. She has lived in Iran, Spain, Italy, and the United Arab Emirates, and currently splits her time between Florence, Italy, and South Bend, Indiana, where she teaches in the MFA program at the University of Notre Dame, with specialties in fiction writing, Latin American and Iberian literature, and literature and translation. Azarine Vandervliet Alumi is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her much-anticipated new novel out from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, entitled Call Me Zebra, a book that Kirkus, in its starred review, calls a bombastic homage to the metacriticism of Borges, the romantic absurdity of Cervantes, and the punk rock autofictions of Kathy Acker. This is a brilliant, demented, and bizarro book that demands and rewards all the attention a reader might dare to give it. The Los Angeles Review of Books says, Vandervliet Alumi captures the shattered identity of the refugee and the immigrant, the way that literature becomes a lifeline in exile, a movable home, a network of dissent, a genealogy beyond national borders. And the Wall Street Journal says, hearken ye fellow misfits, migrants, outcasts, squint-eyed bibliophiles, library haunters, and bookstall stalkers, here is a novel for you. Welcome to Between the Covers, Azarine Vandervliet Alumi.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd love to start our conversation with a little bit of world building together. For those who haven't yet read Call Me Zebra, both the circumstances of Zebra's life and this enchanting, labyrinthine philosophy that sort of emerges from the circumstance that she inherits. So let's start with the circumstance of Bibi Abbas Abbas Husseini, who eventually becomes called Zebra. Tell us about her family and family lineage she has been born into.
Yeah, so Bibi has... She was born in Iran, and during the Iran-Iraq War, she and her father and mother escape to the north near the Caspian, where the family has this really sort of eccentric home that they refer to as the Oasis of Book, of Books, or the Censorship Recovery Center. And it's a space that the family, who's, you know, come from a long lineage of autodidacts, anarchists, and atheists, have been retreating to during times of censorship or political oppression. And from there, they set off on foot to Turkey, and then eventually to Barcelona and New York City. And we then encounter Zebra. She renames herself Zebra when her father passes away. And that's when we pick up the story, and she's decided to retrace the path of their exile after his death.
And one of the things that's interesting about the patrilineal lineage for Zebra is, even before they're in exile, there's a sense of there being a borderlessness to their appetites in terms of literature.
That's right. Her father is a big fan of Nietzsche, and at the same time really does believe that literature is the only nation without boundaries, with no checkpoints, no caste system. And so they read everything, and he reads to her from the moment she's born. So he'll read medieval Japanese literature to her, and then he'll read Dante and all the big philosophers. And he sort of builds this constellation of sentences in her mind. And she then refers to literature as a kind of superhighway of sentences that are interconnected. So it's a very transnational project at all times. And that's the way that she comes to see it.
Well, in the first chapter, Zebra, she presents the worldview of her father and her father's fathers. Mm-hmm. That's been passed down to her. This world, as you described, of the mind and of books and the history of thought. And when she is in New York in the very beginning of, not too far into the novel, she loses her dad. And thus she's the only person left living in this constructed universe. Mm-hmm. And so, as you mentioned, she tries to retrace and reverse the history of exile of the family, and calls it the Grand Tour of Exile, and is moving from the new world to the old world. And her father had said to her that memorization is our only recourse against loss. It sort of feels like this geographical retracing of their flight becomes an unexpected way to memorize. So I wanted, if you could talk a little bit about, obviously in the most literal sense, he's talking about memorizing texts, but yeah, in a way it also feels like Zebra is doing this reverse exile as a form of memorization.
Absolutely. I think that's what Zebra discovers when she goes on this journey. Her intention is to go back and read all of the books in situ, right? So the books that her father would have read while they were in Barcelona, she wants to reread them in Barcelona as a way of trying to understand what could have been going through his mind. I neglected to mention that her mother dies while they're traveling on foot from Iran to Turkey, and part of Zebra's buried grief has to do with that unacknowledged loss, or that sort of trauma early on. And the father's death then sort of solidifies the sense of loss that she has, and she begins to go on these walks that she calls these literary pilgrimages of fragmentation, or burying excavated self, or excavating buried selves. And in the process, she realizes that so many of our memories are actually embedded in space, and that history leaves a trace in our bodies, in our architecture, in our art, and that literature, she sort of starts to inhabit that space where there's a deep intersection between literature and landscape, or literature and architecture. And she realizes that she's always living in a representation of the world in art rather than within the world itself. But she even questions whether or not one can live in the world unmediated, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, the big philosophy of the matrix of literature starts really on these long walks that she goes on while she's reading.
Hmm. Well, there are two maxims that Zebra inherits that I'd like to discuss sort of next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
One, that there's no such thing as reading, only rereading.
Right.
And the other, that memorization is a way to resist colonization. So if we think of Zeber's retracing of her family's flight as a form of memorization, as a recourse against loss, and also maybe a rereading of her own life, I was wondering if you could speak to the ways memorization of text or of place is an anti-colonial act.
Yeah, I mean, in her case in particular, so much about who she is, her body, and her sort of story has been narrativized for her, right? Whether that be in the immigrant experience that she has in the United States or in Spain, but then also the ways in which people's narratives or stories or identities are repressed even within their own homelands, right? So early on in Iran, the father is this sort of very committed intellectual and understands that the Iranian revolution is going to be hijacked and refuses to kind of participate in the uprisings just because of his untrusting nature. But also because of his deep commitment to having memorized all of these texts through time, he understands that history is going to come back to settle its old scores at any moment. And I think that for Zebra, the memorization of the texts is a reminder that you're never safe, that history is always going to pick a new victim, and also a way of being able to recreate that history so that people's stories aren't forgotten. So it's sort of a project of oral history, but through memorization, and it's also a relationship that I think a lot of people in exile have to memory in general, right? You preserve the memory by retelling it over and over and over again. And there's great risk in forgetting the story. There is a further risk of erasure in that forgetting that she's very aware of.
Yeah. You've said before that you were thinking a lot about the relationship between literature and landscape.
Yeah.
And of what it would be to abandon the so-called new world and return to live in the old in order to sink into what you call the architecture of deep time.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, your current life going between Italy and Indiana is various iterations and reiterations of this question I'm imagining. But can you talk to us about this twinning of the old world with deep time and what that means?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it means something different to me than it does to the narrator of Call Me Zebra. I think that what I knew, but then realized fully in writing this book, is the dissociation that we feel or see in the new world. This kind of, and we see this especially now with the rise of racist politics, right? This feeling that the new world is isolated and not connected to anything that came before, or that people who arrived here long ago should have suspended their memories of that journey in order to fully lay claim to this land, right? And there are narratives of ownership that I think are deeply problematic and connected to a kind of suppression of those memories of being outcasts or migrants and landing here and then essentially occupying, right, the land. So that dissociative nature, I think, we see return in these very violent ways in our culture. I mean, we're seeing it now, and it's always been present. But I think it's a kind of deep, unacknowledged grief. And the landscape, I suppose, in the South, it's somewhat different. But I've never lived in the South. I've lived on the coasts, and the sort of, especially on the West Coast, the newness of the landscape and the architecture supports a kind of mental condition of forgetting, right? Mm-hmm. Because nothing in the environment is necessarily cueing us or triggering us to constantly have to participate in a culture of memory. In the old world, right, you're surrounded by architecture and history, and you can see all the stratified layers. So, for example, in Italy, you can sort of see exactly where the World War II bombings occurred, and there will be historic buildings flush against sort of restored buildings from the aftermath of the Second World War. And that kind of texture or overlapping is a palimpsest, right? That really fascinates me, and I think is a sort of natural cultural memory that people participate in. Mm. Yeah.
Well, before we talk more about literature and its intersection with the landscape, I just wanted to touch briefly on something that I came across about your own life growing up.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe is the flip side of or the dark side of memorization. And I think of, for Zebra, this movable home, this way mm-hmm. to this anti-colonial act that sort of preserves identity as she moves from place to place is this act of memorization. But when you were a sixth grader and mm-hmm. the Ayatollah came back from his own exile, there was a different sort of memorization that you had to do. Can you talk a little bit
yeah,
about that?
Yeah, I can. I was a sixth grader, when this incident occurred, but the Ayatollah had already come back quite some time ago. So I was, there in the early 90s. And in class, we were asked to copy the story of Ayatollah's arrival to Iran from France and this heroic journey and salvation narrative about five times. We had to copy this story into our notebooks, and we had never been asked to do something like that before. Copying actually and dictation was something that we had to do regularly as a way of making sure we were learning to spell correctly, etc. And I think it's a vintage technology that people don't use in the classroom anymore. But when that happened, when we were asked to sort of copy his story and his journey, I just protested in class and said that I thought it was a form of brainwashing and that I didn't want to participate. And of course, I was suspended for, I can't remember how long it was for, but when I went home, my mom didn't even blink an eye. She was like, good job. But yeah, I sort of, had a kind of rebellious nature, I suppose, from when I was very young. Yeah.
But it also points to something about Zebra's family. You say they're autodidacts and atheists. And there's one more A.
Yeah, anarchists.
And anarchists. That even if they hadn't been forced into exile, there's a way in which they're sort of in exile, even
Absolutely.
When they're connected to their own land and culture.
Absolutely. And I think Zebra's journey is in part understanding the faults in that, right? That her father, it's a cruel kind of love. I mean, they're so close, but she's just so isolated from others. And I think it's the relationship with the philologist, right, Ludo Bembo, that eventually forces her to look at that. And it's a kind of painful reflection, but it's the only way that she does actually change somewhat through the course of the novel.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to the writer Azarine van der Vliet Alumi about her latest book, Call Me Zebra. So the writer Enrique Villamatas, he coined the phrase literature sickness,
mm-hmm.
Something that in your book, Zebra suffers great bouts of. And you wrote this really interesting piece about it for The Believer. And you're looking primarily at Henry James' Portrait of a Lady and Lynn Tillman's Motion Sickness. And in it, you describe literature sickness as a feverish obsession with reading and with viewing the world through the lens of literature. And we definitely see this mm-hmm. with our protagonist, the way that literature is informing her choices in the book and how she's trying to live out her family's commandments of literature is your sword and seek refuge in literature with writers like Walter Benjamin or Dante, which feel mm-hmm. as flesh and blood and as vital to mm-hmm. her in the book, to me, as her own family, like mm-hmm. even maybe more present in some regards than her own family. And she even consults books in an oracular fashion, opening up books to get wisdom. You have this great quote from that Believer essay that I'd love for you to elaborate on, but in relationship to Zebra. So you say, while the compulsion to read threatens to erode the reader's sense of reality, it also uncovers some hidden truth about the nature of the self in light of the very reality it is required to operate. In other words, it erodes one in order to unveil the other. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that a little?
Yeah. So for me, the great book of literature sickness, and I think probably for Enrique Villamatas as well, is Don Quixote, where you have this very picaresque, kind of funny, hysterical narrator who so deeply is invested in literature that he believes he can reinvent himself as a literary figure and go on these kinds of journeys through Spain. And because it's really an exploration of the difference between like perception or reality, right? The mind encountering the world. And oftentimes there's an incongruity there that can be really tragic or really funny or both. And I just love that character of Don Quixote and the ways in which he makes me laugh out loud when I'm reading his sort of his monologues, and the way that he can convince himself that something he's seeing is something a representation of something he's read in one of the chivalric tales that he's obsessed with. And I think that the Believer essay is sort of about exploring the ways in which realism itself is a kind of construct, right? It's not a one-to-one representation of reality. It's a kind of hyperbolic representation of space and psychology and the body. And in a book that's both exercising realism and at the same time about obsession with reading, the way that we see in Tillman's work or Henry James's work, what we're getting is a kind of mapping of consciousness through time onto the page. And so you're both getting the signposts of realism and being mesmerized or hypnotized into thinking that you're experiencing this perfectly constructed story world that's sort of mimicking our world. But there's so many layers of depth to it that the deeper you descend, it begins to erode at that idea that this is a stable representation, mm-hmm. right? That it's static. And I think that's something both Tillman and Henry James do so beautifully, is just, it's a descent reading their work through literature, but also you eventually go through the sort of realism, right? The curtain of realism, you go through it and then you're looking at the backstage, right? At how it was constructed. And that in of itself makes you question what you're reading or think more deeply about this idea that realism is somehow representation or truth, or that there's a one-to-one relationship, like I was saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of a lot of complex ideas, but I think really simple at its core is that we can't really perceive a kind of solid static realism with a capital R. I mean, that's not how our minds work.
Well, I wonder if you're also going at, can we even achieve a solid static selfhood with mm-hmm. a capital S? Because you talk about how Tillman's book reveals the unreality of self. And at another point you say, at their core, books that explore what it means to inhabit life through literature are also examining the intersubjective nature of consciousness, probing the gap between perception and reality. And I wondered if these two things are inextricably linked, mm-hmm. the unreality of self and in the intersubjective nature of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like when I think about this going into depth,
right.
then I think about deep time and the palimpsest when you're looking at Italy. Maybe that's also the same in our mind. Like the more you mm-hmm. go through the layers, the more you see other people in your own mind, like Zebra's
Absolutely.
Seeing in herself.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of, well, it goes to the heart of individualism and what is individualism, right? If the self isn't static, which I don't think it is, right? It's kind of this like kaleidoscopic, moving, dynamic force. And it's deeply interconnected to other people, to space, to history, everything that we've inherited, right? Even through our genetic coding. There's no such thing as a kind of self that exists separate from others or separate from the environment. And that is such a comforting notion for me, that I don't know, it's almost sort of has some sort of Buddhist resonances, right? That mm-hmm. Where there is just one fabric, and if you move something on one end, something else is, everything else is going to shift to adjust to it or to react to it in some ways. And to come back to Zebra, what she's trying to do is to access this space. But of course, it's so difficult to access. And often we only access that kind of deep peace just momentarily. And then we're back in the kind of chaos and the sort of veneer of reality. But she is trying to account for life as a kind of totality that includes both the possibility of our death, our actual death, and our lives, and the ways in which there are parts of us that die when we lose people or we're displaced. And she talks about Blanchot a lot and his idea that the totality is unreal, right? So if you look at the self or you look at totality, there is a kind of unreality to it because you can't measure it. You can't contain it. It's so much vaster and bigger and more movable than we're often comfortable with.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but I thought about Zebra's selfhood and the moving from the so-called new world to the so-called old world, which some people might think of as facing backwards. Mm. It reminded me of something that Forrest Gander has said in a description of the language and gestures of the Bolivian people, the Aymara. Mm. They're the only known people where spatially the future is behind them. So because you can't see it, you can't see the future. And yeah. so the past is in front of them. And when they gesture about something that's happened in the past, when they're accessing memory, they gesture forward. And when I think of Zebra and the Aymara, it makes me think that it isn't a coincidence that the other books of literature sickness that you examined also involve people moving from the new world to the old world.
Yeah.
So we have this, I wondered about looking back, or as Aymara would say, looking forward into the mm-hmm. past.
Yeah, I love that. It's so interesting. I mean, Zebra talks about the future as being history, right? Or that history is the future. And she talks about, she's really interested in precognition and has these kinds of, like you said, she consults these texts, these older medieval or even before then, these texts as oracles of wisdom to see what's coming, right? And news of the future for her is embedded in the past and for her father as well. And I think that it's really interesting to think about Henry James or Lynn Tillman in relation to passports. James in particular, who sort of acquired his British citizenship not long before he passed away. But then I also think about the reverse, Nabokov and his relationship to his documents of immigration and his passports, and this kind of, on the one hand for Nabokov, accumulation of new selves that he has to perform, right? Mm-hmm. Because they exist, this self has been documented in a new passport, and now he has to invent that self in order to perform it. Versus in Henry James, he's almost like shedding the passports and arriving at this sort of what to him feels like some authentic self, which of course I question that word, but
right.
It's an interesting kind of thing to think about.
Well, I mean, the first, you mentioned Don Quixote is the quintessential book of literature sickness, and it was the first book I thought of with this, with Zebra, and partially because she's moving, she's creating reality as she moves through the world through the reality she's constructing in her mind and in relationship to other books. And I want to talk more about Don Quixote, but I was wondering if maybe you could also point us to any other examples that mm-hmm. you particularly like in the lit sick genre.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think of Dante's The Divine Comedy as being completely about literature sickness, whether it's his relationship to theological texts or to Virgil, right? I mean, Virgil guides him through hell and I think purgatory as well. And that's a book to me that's deeply about literature sickness. let me think off the top of my head. The, Enrique Villamata's, the one that I love the most, is called Montano's Malady, and it's a great translation out with New Directions. And then there is Valeria Luiselli's The Story of My Teeth, which also references a lot of Petrarch and other kinds of books. And Petrarch himself is another good example of someone who's engaged with these other texts. And then there's a tradition of doing that in Japanese literature with Basho. And it's his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which includes these walking pilgrimages to sites that other poets had traveled to, and he records their poems and meditates on them and then composes his own poems in response. So there's a lot of...
So Zebra would have liked that book.
Yeah. I've read that book quite a number of times, and I just... It's very slow and meditative, but I absolutely love it, yeah.
So if we were to move on to Don Quixote in relationship to this book, the place where I feel like there's the deepest resonance is in the way you portray the romantic relationship between Zebra and the philologist, the Italian philologist, Ludo Bembo, her on-again, off-again love affair with him. So that's sort of the source of both the book's tension and also a lot of its humor.
Yeah.
And it's also the place where we most experience the limitations of Zebra's own self-narrative. It's the place where we can see around the way she presents the world to us. So we start to see like, oh, this world seems like it's hermetic and perfected, and yet there's some, it's also producing some difficulties for her, particularly in the romantic world. But it made me think of the similar relationship between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Yeah. With Quixote, he has the fever, sort of the feverish imaginative life. He's even tall and skinny and not really, he's more otherworldly in a bodily sense, and Panza is motivated by the appetites of the world. And here we have Zebra as almost a disembodied character. She hardly eats. She's ruminating all the time. She's tormented by her exile, her absence of home, and like her ancestors, finds her home in the world of words. But in an ironic way, even though she finds a home in the world of words, she's exiled from her body. So in a way, she's kind of living off of the words as her food. I was ready to devour the next sentence, to eat Benjamin quoting Hegel, to consume an infinitely receding sequence of quotes, which again gives us that layering that you wouldn't see in Los Angeles, but you'd see in Italy. But Ludo's the polar opposite, exasperatingly so, to Zebra. He's practical. He's equally interested in language, but it's a more practical sort of engagement with the text. and I think in the Los Angeles Review of Books, it's described as performing autopsies on textual cadavers while Zebra is the mad writer who Frankensteins them into a living monster. That's pretty awesome. And he's really into food and sex, the pleasures of life. He's an embodied character. You've created this inextricable pair, like in Don Quixote. So I was just hoping you'd talk more about Ludo and the role, which feels like a vital role. I can't imagine the book without him.
Yeah, neither can I. Actually, I started working on this book in 2010, and I was doing the background research and just kind of reading all these writers of exile. But when I started writing, two or three years after that, the first thing that appeared on the page was Ludo Bembo. And it was the breakup scene that we get towards the end of the book, that first kind of rupture in the relationship where he's just had enough of her, and he's trying to reflect sort of the ways in which she's perpetuating exile or rejection or alienation, right? Without intending to, of course, but he reflects this back to her. And there, it's also where all the humor, like you said, in the book comes from. I mean, I think this book is deeply tragic, but it's also very comical. And that's due to the fact that the two of them are kind of pushing and pulling each other across the Mediterranean. And They're both very intelligent people, but of course, like you said, he's so much more pragmatic. He's really interested in the history of the definition of words and in dictionaries, and he has this great sort of recitation of all the different definitions of exile that he kind of lashes at her, against her with, while she's listening to all the other pilgrims of exile or the void come up with what exile feels like for them, like what are their personal definitions of exile. And he's really interested in like the sort of the book, right? What does the dictionary say exile means? And he's very concrete and frustrating in that way to her, and mm-hmm. she's of course maddening to him.
Yeah, I love it. I'm glad I'm not in it, but I love to read
about
it.
Nice to witness.
Yeah. So there are a lot of ironies. There's a lot of absurdist humor, but there's also a lot of ironies. For instance, as the last of an ancestral lineage, Zebra reminds the reader that she carries this great weight of responsibility. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't just manifest as the need to preserve the wisdom of her family of autodidacts and atheists and anarchists, but from the humor perspective, she's also literally carrying things around, objects she's inherited, stained rugs, a rolled up portrait of a duck, a samovar, even her dead father in a suitcase at one point. And one tragic irony of this is that this is all in response to being exiled and feeling othered no matter where she goes. So it's this act of sort of desperate preservation. But though, even though it's an act of love toward her parents, it sort of becomes a fortress. Mm-hmm. She's not capable of engaging with the other, mm-hmm. Of creating space in her heart for the real embodied otherness of this man in her life, for loving a living person, mm-hmm. Even though she's defining herself through otherness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the danger of all of her thinking, of our sort of hyper intellectualism and this cerebral way in which she goes through the world. And I think that it's the relationship with Ludo that eventually allows us as readers to see that the boundary between the victim and the victimizer is blurry, and that violence, when this kind of deep historical violence, has so many subconscious ways of reproducing itself, and that in fact the more she holds on to her grief, the more she's perpetuating this form of psychological or emotional exile, including toward herself, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't live from the heart in any way, and a lot of what her journey is about is actually to question whether or not she's ever been loved, if she knows what that is, and to think, you know, what is love, and how do we love ourselves? How do we nurture each other? And she eventually does realize that her biggest revenge as an exiled body is, in fact, to lay claim to love, right? Mm-hmm. And to make space for that. And I think that's where sort of we part with her, right? Is because there are no easy resolutions in a situation like this. And I definitely didn't want this, you know, big redemptive arc, because I don't think that's the way we resolve our trauma, right? It's not in one instance, or it's not in one epiphany. It's a constant returning to and trying to sort of crack away at the bricks in those walls little by little over a lifetime in order to sort of get on the other side. Yeah.
One of the things she feels with regards to Ludo is a difference in the way they are oriented towards exile.
Yeah.
So there's various terms that are in her worldview that she's inherited, and one of them is the pyramid of exile. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the pyramid of exile in relationship to the way she looks at her potential romantic partner, mm-hmm. and maybe ways in which she doesn't feel like she can cross over and feel seen by him because of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the pyramid of exile is one of those theories she constructs as she's leaving the new world, and it's deeply serious but also very funny in the way that she's sort of goes on this long monologue about the Pyramid of Exile and who's on the bottom of the pyramid, who's in the middle, who's on top. And she sort of starts to think about there are lots of people who are below her, who are suffering even more, and who are refugees without documentation, who, you know, die in the process of getting across the Mediterranean. And she refers to the Mediterranean as the Sea of Sunken Hopes. And then there are people like herself who are sort of in the middle of the pyramid and who are displaced or in exile, but, you know, chose to flee, were able to eventually, whether, you know, by hook or by crook, somehow acquire documentation and therefore can come and go. And then she thinks about people like Ludo Bembo, who are at the top and they get the most amount of oxygen because they're standing on everyone else's shoulders, who are expats, right? So Ludo is an Italian philologist who's displaced in Spain as a result of sort of like the environment Berlusconi has created in Italy. And she believes that they're the most well-off, right, within this pyramid. And she doesn't think that he can ever really understand, just like she can never fully understand the pain of the people who she feels she's standing on their shoulders, right? And I think it, for me, and I think eventually for Zebra, this is another way in which we're all interconnected, right? Herself, the definitions of who she is, are not separate from her awareness of this kind of huge machinery of power, right, that we're all implicated in. And so through that, we're deeply connected, whether it's through the ways in which we acquire wealth or freedom or oxygen or diminish someone else's, that, you know, again, that's the fabric, right, that we're living in.
Yeah. Well, even though this book feels clearly like a fiction, there are ways it also sort of feels like an imaginative rereading of your own family story of exile, or like that this is a fictional palimpsest atop an autobiographical inquiry. Like Zebra, your family left Iran as exiles. You lived in innumerable places while growing up. Spain was a particularly notable place of transition for you. And is also the main locale of the novel. And the main love interest in the book is with an Italian. Your husband is Italian. And I'm by no means suggesting that I think Zebra is you. But I'd love to mine the gap a little between the fiction you've created and, and your own life. Particularly the literary pilgrimages that Zebra does when she's in Spain. Pilgrimages centered around writers who have experienced some form of exile themselves, and your own literary pilgrimages that you did while living in Spain, and that involved you using books instead of maps or books as maps to find out where to go. So can you speak about the pilgrimages on their own, but also maybe how they're informing the ones in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're right to say that this is a kind of fictional autobiography, or it's playing with that genre. I was consciously toying with the idea of dramatizing aspects of my own life and seeing how, in the Borgesian sense, that would shift my relationship to myself as a writer and also complicate it in a way, and how these inventions of these selves through Zebra would then mirror something back to me that I couldn't know unless I had written this book. And it's also certainly an intellectual autobiography for me. My family, they actually weren't big readers, so that's completely fictional. They're definitely not anarchists, atheists, or autodidacts, although my father is somewhat of an autodidact and a very kind of, I would say, reclusive character. And he's Dutch and a sea captain and spent a lot of his time at sea. And I grew up mainly with my mother and that side of the family. So in some senses, all of the deep grief and the emotions that Zebra, explores in the novel are also feelings that I've had to navigate, of displacement, of figuring out how to kind of deal with that line of being the outsider and resisting maybe or complicating for people the stories that they invent for you, right? When they don't know what box to fit you in. So there's that. And I do feel strongly about acknowledging that, right? And at the same time, this book sort of is so strange. And it, the only way that it could be honest is if it became radically strange and other to me. And so when I read it, my experience is quite uncanny. I don't recognize myself in it. But I do remember, of course, the writing process being very difficult. I laughed a lot, but I also, you know, wept a lot writing it. So I think I'm forgetting the second part of your question.
The second part's about the walking.
Oh, right.
So
right.
The walking you did in Catalonia without maps.
Yeah.
And what was impelling that yeah. journey, and how that intersects with the pilgrimages in the book.
Yeah. So I got the Fulbright to go and do background research for this novel. And as it turns out, I wasn't actually emotionally mature enough to know what I was doing, right? Mm. I mean, I had to kind of, our writing self, I truly believe, is ahead of our world self. And there was a lot of catching up I had to do. So I had this kind of project in mind that I was going to go and research Josep Pla's work and his relationship to the Catalan landscape, and then read other writers of exile and think about the ways in which history or trauma are embedded in the landscape. But for so long, I didn't understand why I needed to do this. And once I was there, the only thing I could do in order to kind of break into that or gain understanding was to start going on these walks, these pilgrimages with his books, and then with Rodoreda's books. And then I went to Port Bo, where Walter Benjamin committed suicide on the border with France. And I didn't have maps. We didn't use technology. And he was my future husband at that point. Leonardo did these walks with me. And we were also kind of thinking about what do journeys mean, and how can we sort of travel locally with the same electric energy you would set off on a long kind of journey to a faraway place with. And part of accomplishing that was actually making the space unfamiliar to ourselves and reading the books and trying to trace, look at spaces that were described in the books, and then go to those locations and see if those spaces still look the same or still existed. And in a lot of cases, they didn't. Or in a lot of cases, we would have to kind of walk across the old railroad tracks to the old road that they would travel on with donkeys. And we got lost a lot. And we also had so much fun. And we wrote for Words Without Borders. So a lot of those early pilgrimages that then, when I finally had the maturity to write the book, got recast in a much more fictionalized, dramatic way in the book we wrote early on. Yeah.
Can you talk about your attraction to Catalonian literature or Catalan writers? Why is Josep Pla play such a significant role in the book and in these pilgrimages, for instance?
Yeah, when we lived in Spain, we were in Valencia, and they speak Valencia, which is very, you know, it's Catalan. It just has a slightly different inflection to it. And so I grew up with Catalan in my ear. And it's just, I don't know what it is about it, but it just kind of, the frequency of the language, the tone, especially the way that the vowels are pronounced, just kind of grabs my heart. And of course, it's one of those things you just don't know why that is, right? Like sometimes you listen to a piece of music and everything in you changes for just that one moment. So for me, reading Catalan literature has that.
So is it?
Yeah.
Do these writers are they engaged with the theme of exile, or is it more the sound of the language almost being the attraction of a home?
Well, it depends on the writer. So Mercé Rodoreda, the book of hers that I absolutely love, was written in exile about the Spanish Civil War and the time of the doves. And she wrote that when she was in France. And it's an absolutely stunning work. Very simple, deceptively simple sentences that kind of accumulate into this emotional, complex space, or you know, it's narrative through accumulation. And José Pla has that same kind of very direct, almost sort of severe delivery of sentences. And it's in the way that they accumulate, paragraph after paragraph, that you really start to get a feeling for how passionate he was as a writer. Because if you just read a few pages, it's hard to really capture that. But he spent his whole life having to deal with these very deeply conflicting sides of his personality. He was deeply Catholic. He was also a fervent Catalanist. And of course, during the Civil War, those two identities couldn't coexist, right? Because you had the Franco, who was kind of conservative and Catholic, and the oppression of the Catalans that happened during Franco and his long dictatorship. And so, you know, Pla was kind of left neither here nor there. So I think I'm more interested in his identity and in the way that somehow through the course of history, his identity always trapped him and cornered him. No matter what was going on, he always seemed to land on the wrong side of the line. Mm. And he just wrote, I think, maniacally as a coping mechanism, but also to leave a record of the territory, the food,
and yeah, what the book weather. should we start with?
Well, he's only begun to get translated into English recently. So the book of his that I absolutely love, The Gray Notebook, is actually published by the New York Review of Books. And it's phenomenal. The translation is great. Archipelago also has published, I think it's Life and Bitters. And I'm hoping more of his work will be translated into English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the conspicuous absences in the grand tour of exile for Zebra is she doesn't go to Iran.
Yeah.
And you haven't been back since you were young either, I don't believe.
I haven't.
But did you ever, were you ever tempted to imagine yourself there in the narrative, or imagine Zebra there in the return?
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal, right? She wants to reverse and retrace the path all the way. And I don't want to give too much away, but I think she, of course, you know, realizes the impossibility of that, and the fact that it's basically a suicidal project. And thankfully, it's the digression with Ludo that allows her to come to terms with that, and realizing that it's her desire to go back has so much more to do with not knowing how to grieve the loss of her mother, right? And once she figures out how to grieve that, the absence of Iran is extraordinarily painful, but she's able to hold it. And yeah, I wish I could go back every day, you know, of course.
Well, in your Twitter profile, you describe yourself as a transnational body. And recently I've been preparing for an interview with Molly Crabapple about her upcoming memoir about the Syrian war.
Mm-hmm.
And she tweeted the phrase "borders kill" recently. And when I was thinking about the transnational body and both the arbitrariness and lethality of borders, it made me think of a past interview I had with Yanara Friedland. I don't know if you read her book, The Uncountry.
No, I haven't.
Her book, Uncountry, it feels like a kindred spirit to Call Me Zebra. Not, it doesn't read anything like it tonally, syntactically. It's a very different reading experience, but it raises questions of identity
and
lineage
in
relationship
from
to
the
exile.
Booth,
from
the weekly segment from
and,
people
and she
inside
took the title of her
and
book
around
from a quote
Kebu
by Alain
with news
Sitsu,
from your community goes, radio station.
I want the word uncountry. I am sorry we don't have it, since uncountry is not supposed to exist. I like beings who belong to removal inhabitants of the uncountry, of the in-country, of the country hidden in the country or lost in the country, of the other country, the country below, the country underneath. And then Friedland herself says, In essence, the task the book proposes is to string and build connection to that and those beyond our immediate association of nation and citizenship, the identity markers we are born into, and to imagine lineages that live within us, contradicting inherited narratives. I do think, however, that this must always happen after a confrontation and untangling of our more immediate bonds, or in other words, the reaching beyond ourselves begins at the center, slowly rippling out. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize that this is not a territorial act, claiming all kinds of subjectivities as our own, but rather an encounter at the boundary of I and thou, in Buber's words. And this feels very akin to Zebra's attempt, mm-hmm. somehow to me, of finding home in a spatialized imagination in an un-country whose inhabitants are also her ancestors, and also the stories of mm-hmm. of people, the stories that her ancestors loved and the stories that she loves, all sort of in this almost mythological space. I just wanted to hear your response to
such a beautiful quote. I'd love to read that book. I think it's actually articulated so concisely something that's so difficult to get at, which is, yeah, precisely this idea that it's in the encounter with the person next to you, in a deep sort of examination of the historical knots that have informed every aspect of your relating to one another, that you're then able to transcend, I think is a slightly problematic word, but to transcend the notion of national boundaries, right? That you can't skip over the interrogation of the sets of relationships that surround you in the countries that we've landed in, right? That there is no way for Zebra to understand what happened to her family or even between her and her father without fully deeply immersing herself in the relationship with Ludo and looking at the ways in which her trauma and her expectations get replayed in that relationship and therefore distort it, right? Mm-hmm. And distort him and the ways in which the things that have informed his life in turn further distort hers, right? That there is a kind of deep acknowledging that needs to occur of even the stuff that we think we're not responsible for, that our ancestors did or thought of or taught us, right? We are responsible for those things, right? I think, you know, if we're talking about them, something like epigenetics, right, the way that trauma gets inherited or passed on across generations, then it's in our bodies, right? We're interacting with one another with all of that. And the more we can be aware of it, I think the more we can be in an un-country, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to return to you and the high bar you set about wanting to change when you do a book, when you mm-hmm. write a book, I know you have a couple manuscripts in progress, and I'm curious what this meditation on exile and place, on love and otherness, an experience that led you to say, maybe not all of our emotions belong to us and not all of our thoughts are our own. We've inherited these things we perform again and again, and landscape really shows that to us. I got to sit with that idea for a prolonged period with this book. So I'm curious what this prolonged period has prompted you to explore next.
Yeah, it's freed me, I think, to write essays, which I wasn't able to do before. It has made my experience of exile more accessible to me and more immediate, because I had to dig around for language that I didn't have before. And once I created the language for talking about the deep loneliness, the strangeness, the sense of futility, right? And at times even a kind of a lack of conviction of, you know, a sense of purpose or sort of what is it that we are living against and living through. I think that having written this book, I'm now able to write about those things unapologetically, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a way in which when you don't have language for these things, it creates so much shame and so much internal sort of atmospheric oppression that it's disorienting within itself. So it's almost as if there's this deep turbulence within you all of the time. And I was able to go into the turbulence. I mean, it took 7 years, and it maybe that's not that long after all, but it feels long to me since I've only been around for 34. So it's sort of, yeah, I'm not afraid of it anymore now.
Well, thanks for being on the show today, Azri.
Thank you so much for your very thoughtful questions and the conversation. I appreciate it.
We're talking today to Azarine Vanderfleet Alumi about her latest book, Call Me Zebra. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 20 de mayo del 2021. Con las variantes brasileña y británica circulando ampliamente en Argentina, los pacientes que están viendo ahora en el Hospital Público Fernández en Buenos Aires están muriendo más rápido y son más jóvenes. Una víctima reciente solo tenía 42 años. Una segunda ola devastadora de casos de COVID tomó a Argentina con la guardia baja, con restricciones relajadas y una baja tasa de vacunación. Los casos han aumentado de un total diario de alrededor de 5.000 a principios de marzo a un